Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Jeeves, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
Good evening, everybody. Well, happy Wednesday. Welcome to another episode of the Voice of Indie podcast. This is episode number 110. I am your host, Mr. Beam Weeks, and with me is my co-host, Stephen Jeeves. How are you doing tonight, Stephen?
I'm just doing great. It's a warm, sunny afternoon here on the day that we're actually recording, but I hope it's nice where everybody is this evening as well. It's been a wild and crazy week. I fell a couple of weeks ago, and my shoulder is still hurting, so now we're getting into MRIs and medical expenses and all kinds of fun things. So, how about you, Beam? You feeling better than I do?
I'm feeling pretty good. As Stephen just mentioned, this episode is pre-recorded. We are off this night. It's a brand new episode with a brand new guest, so stick around. But the phone lines are closed, and we're not on Twitter tonight. So now I may actually drop in during the airing of this if you've got questions or comments on Twitter.
I probably will, too.
Yeah, so keep that in mind. You can still use Twitter, hashtag Fresh Ink Group, but the phone lines are closed, so there's that. But yeah, we're today, while we're recording this, beautiful sunny day up here in Michigan, 75 degrees, not too hot, not too cold, just perfect. So enjoying the tailings of summer.
Yeah, my big project for the week, believe it or not, is trying to get a pair of concert tickets. My lady friend's favorite band is Eagles, as you would say, Eagles, not the Eagles.
Never the Eagles. I'm good to correct people on that one.
Right, it's just Eagles, the name of the band. And they've announced a new show. They're coming to Birmingham, Alabama, which is like an hour from where she lives. So buying concert tickets has gotten beyond stupid weird. For one thing, a lot of these bands are using dynamic pricing now, meaning that if there's a huge demand, you go in there, people start buying tickets, and they're being snapped up quickly, then they raise the prices. The prices on the tickets actually change while you're buying them. And this just went nuts recently with the Bruce Springsteen ticket sales, where pairs of tickets were rising as much as to $10,000 per seat.
He's not worth that. I'm not a Springsteen fan, but not worth 10 grand.
Well, a lot of people are paying it. But we've decided, okay, if I can get a pair of these Eagle tickets, we'll go $1,000 for a pair of tickets. That's as high as we're going to go. And if we can't get a pair for that, then we're not going to see the Eagles this time. But it's just ridiculous, because now you have to get pre-sale codes, because concert tickets go on sale usually the day before the public can get at them, and then they sell out during the pre-sale. So how do you get tickets if you can't get plugged into that system and work it? And I went through that a couple of months ago trying to get Kevin Hart tickets, and I spent hours on the computer getting in lines and then getting knocked out of the lines because of the demand was so high. And it just went – it's very difficult. I kind of like the old days when you just drove down to Detroit and stood in line all night at the box office and waited for them to open and bought your tickets.
Yeah, we talked about this the other day. You know, I remember my first concerts, this is 40-odd years ago, you could go to the record store. Kids, we used to have a thing called a record store. You could go down there and get tickets if you wanted to, or go down to the arena where their show was going to be, and like Steven said, wait in line at the box office. Some of us even camped out overnight. I did that a time or two. I feel sorry for today's kids who want to go to concerts to see their favorite performers today, because they're being priced out of it if they don't have wealthy parents who will, you know, kick in the money for those tickets. And number two, like you said, you've got to wait in line online, get a code and all this jump through hoop stuff, and it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's discouraging, and like you said, it prices people out. I took a 13-year-old to see his favorite band a couple months ago called ADR. I never even heard of them. And, you know, and he's like, oh, man, he really want to do it. I said, all right, I'll take you. Wound up costing me $600. And it's like, woo, okay. I'm glad he enjoyed the show. But, geez, what would a 13-year-old do about seeing his favorite band if he didn't have somebody willing to spend $600?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And he'd miss it. That's the bottom line is
yeah.
He would miss it.
I mean,
and back when I was 13, 14, we were seeing bands for $3, $4, $5, $6 a ticket.
Yeah, my first concert, it was $8 for the ticket and $8 for the concert T-shirt. So you walked away just spending $16, and it was a good time.
Yeah. So, indie musicians, we love supporting you. We like having you on the podcast. We like helping promote you and get you out there and help you build that audience. But when you get to $10,000 a seat, I don't know about that.
No.
So, listeners, we got some recent releases. We've got Practical Problems, which is 10 short plays by J. Ash Looney, is now out there, available everywhere. And Submariner by retired Naval Lieutenant Commander Jerry Pate and compiled by science fiction and thriller maven author Robert G. Williscroft. And that's Submariner, and it's 60 true tales about the lieutenant commander of such important missions as the spaceship shuttle recovery, and a whole lot of other interesting things as well. So check those books out. We got a few more, Beam?
We do. We've got Water Lilies Over My Grave by Patricia A. Guthrie is out. So get over there to Amazon, grab a copy. And Still Not Enough, Minority Millennials in the Workplace by Janelle A. Jordan is available as well. So, and I understand that's doing pretty good. It did in the pre-sale and all that, so.
Yeah, we've had three weeks in a row of it being our number one print bestseller. And this one's selling almost as well. About 90% of the numbers that we're getting for soft covers, we're getting for hard covers. So
all right.
we're seeing upticks in hardcover sales across all genres and among many of our authors. And we've got half a dozen authors right now with books out there where the hardcovers are outselling the soft. And
all
that's
right.
Unusual. It's not something that I'm used to seeing.
Now, listeners, if you want more information, you want to keep on top of book releases like this, because we got a bunch more coming up, and anything to do with this show, you want the link for each week, you want the link for this show, who's going to be the guest, you want to know a little something about the guest before the show begins, subscribe to our newsletter, and this is how you can do that.
Stay on top of these podcasts and all things Fresh Ink Group with our weekly digital newsletter, new releases, videos, stories, excerpts, interviews, and more. Sign up now on the homepage of freshinkgroup.com and be the one who knows what's what.
What?
Yeah.
All right.
So, what is this archives that I keep hearing about, Beam?
The archives, every episode that we do, the live shows, and of course this one here is pre-recorded. I'm going to throw that in here again. So the phone lines are not open tonight. This is a pre-recorded episode. Brand new guest, new episode, but it's pre-recorded because the guest isn't able to get in on Wednesday. So what we do after each of these shows is we archive them, and right now we've got them in several places, and you can find them in these places by doing this.
If you miss a show, find us in the archive in the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube, on Spotify, or under the podcast tab at freshinkgroup.com, beamweeks.com, and stephengees.com. On YouTube, be sure to like and subscribe.
Yeah, now I am also looking for other places to archive this. We're trying to get this out everywhere, so I will keep you up to date as I find new places to deposit this program.
All right. So, you think we should bring in this week's guest?
I think so.
Yeah, been looking forward to this. We've known this fellow for many, many years. We were once in a club together a long time ago, and we've been fans of his. And you know, his name comes up every now and then. So
I thought that was a cult,
finally,
wasn't it?
Yeah. We're finally glad to have a chance. Paul de Blasi III, PhD, is a depth psychologist and award-winning writer living in his native New Mexico, crafting metaphysical thrillers energized with trickster mischief and natural magic. His novels, visionary thrillers, delve deep into archetypal realities as they play out dramatically in the lives of everyday people. Metaphysical drama set in the mythopoeic realm of Aslan open vistas of danger, conflict, and potential transformation, Good and Evil are pivotal arenas for unfolding tales of the supernatural. Together with visionary slash metaphysical novels, he also writes blogs and archetypal essays on trauma, dreams, spirituality, and intuition. As a native New Mexican, he has been deeply influenced by the mestizo myth of Aztlan, its surreal beauty and natural magic. Memberships include the Authors Guild, the Depth Psychology Alliance, the International Association for Relational Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy, and the International Association for Jungian Studies. Paul's writing is informed by his personal and clinical understanding of the unconscious mind. Treating patients in depth psychotherapy for over 35 years has inspired stories about human conflict and transformation in the areas of love, relationships, and spirituality. Stories imbued with archetypal symbolism and narrative drama affect the unconscious mind in potentially transformative ways. Inspirational essays in consciousness and depth psychology move into realms of both darkness and hope that can open mystic paths of human experience. Cool. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Welcome, Paul.
Yes, Stephen, Dean, thank you. Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here this morning. It's a beautiful 83 degrees, sunshiny in New Mexico today. So great to be with Fresh Ink.
It's beautiful out there where you are. I've loved traveling through, but like that stretch across New Mexico and Arizona even western Texas, God, some of the scenery is just stunning. Just stunning. I love to climb up on top of things and then wonder why I climbed up there and now how am I going to get down?
There we go. Yeah, that's right.
There's something psychological in there.
We're a mile higher.
So you're living in Albuquerque now. Are you a lifelong Albuquerque resident or have you lived in other parts of New Mexico?
Born and raised here, and went away to school in Chicago, Colorado in Chicago, and came on back 40 years ago and began clinical practice and my family and have been rolling with clinical work in psychotherapy and doing writing ever since.
All right.
So you'll probably be a New Mexican for the rest of your days, I assume. You love it there?
I think it's pretty much sewn into the fiber of my being. My family has I am mestizo. I'm mixed blood. My heritage is Spanish. They came with the Spanish land grant in the 1600s. And settled the Middle Rio Grande Valley, and then my grandmother was a Tsleta Indian. So that and there in De Blasi's came from Naples in 1880 and settled in the what was then an acquisition to the United States. It wasn't even a territory yet in 1880. So you had a lot of Italians immigrating. They actually settled in Boston first for about 8 years. And I learned from my daughter, who's an Italian citizen now, and she did all the history that she lives and teaches in Florence, and so she did all this research, and we actually figured out that my great great grandfather Paolo came actually from Boston to Albuquerque, and then and the rest is history. So yeah, it's pretty much sewn into the fibers of my soul at this point.
Yeah. Well, what was it like growing up with such a rich melange of cultural influences? I mean, that's an interesting mix.
Yeah, it was really fascinating and pretty beautiful, colorful at times. I'm 69, so. A lot of the cultural tensions that were there when I was growing up aren't so apparent, and really through a lot of hard work, you know, in our politics around the country have really shifted. But I was often caught between cultures. And so it was, but very rich, nevertheless. Italian heritage was always very prominent. My grandfather, my great grandfather, was born in Naples and taught me a little bit of Italian and about the culture, and it carried on through the family. And then the Spanish culture, Spanish and Indian culture, which really are New Mexican culture, because New Mexico is its own culture. It's a mixing of Hispanic and natives, especially in our foods and a lot of the aesthetic design and art and the like. So very rich and very satisfying. Yeah.
Reading and writing was important.
Reading and writing, growing up in your childhood, was reading and writing important to you?
Reading and writing I'm the first in my immediate family to attend college. My uncle, though, my father's brother, was a psychologist, and so he really helped to nourish a love of writing. Of reading, and eventually writing. He became chairman of the Department of Psychology at New Mexico State University for 20 years, published a lot, and we were both very interested. He was interested in the psychology of religion. Then I was too. Once I started, I had a very transformative experience when I was 16 years old with Maharishi Yogi. And I began meditating and transcendental meditation, and that opened up whole worlds to me. And I began to read Freud and Jung and got into psychology. And I was talking to my uncle and began reading a lot of psychology. Prior to that, I did the sort of Huck Finn and Superman and Archie comic books. And so it was always fairly, you know, I was that type of I would say everyday reader. And then once I hit my teens, I really got into psychology and religious studies, and William James and Freud and Jung were it. You know, they just satisfied my intellectual and spiritual cravings for something more and deeper, and my introduction to the unconscious, the world of the unconscious and spirituality, was really nourished and began to be nourished then.
That's interesting. A step from the Archies to Carl Jung.
that's quite
a leap.
right. Yeah, and Jung has continued to be a very, although I see him with a little more perspective than a boy and even a younger therapist. I'm able to take, Jung he was a genius. And Freud was as well, William James, of course, in that. And then I've had 40 years of clinical experience, and we've come away since then, you know. But they were my beginning places. And then my writing was very much influenced in the early years by the three of them, and I continue to write professional articles in. Yeah, peer review articles in depth psychology. I just finished one for a colleague, for Routledge Press, that will be published as part of an edited book on illuminative presence, and that's about how in dreams and in what are considered dreams, while sleeping dreams, but also waking dreams, because there is a whole metapsychology, and that's theories that have developed out of clinical experiences about the therapy session itself being a waking dream, where the therapist and patient are in a reverie, and the world of the unconscious begins to float through with images and feelings, very much like the dream world, and we begin to tap into that in a psychoanalytically therapeutic way. So I enter into the same sort of process in my writing, where I move into that liminal space, and I'm in a reverie, and I begin to write. and my writing is loaded. It's replete with the references to the unconscious, to dreams, to synchronous events, to intuition. And it's a whole world of metaphysical drama and good and evil playing out. You have the good guy, the bad guy, and then you let the crazies out, you know, and see what's happened.
Well, now, when you're working with a patient and you're doing that, you're guiding the exploration, I would assume, to a certain extent, and then responding to what kinds of things the patient's discovering or reacting to. But if you're writing, you don't have any feedback or whatever. You have to anticipate what your readers are feeling or experiencing from your words. Do you find that extra challenging or easier, or you don't really worry about it, or what?
Well, it took me a while because it's the writing fiction, writing stories took me, has taken, I'm still learning, every day I'm learning, but it was much more of an immediate an immediate sense of writing that I had with nonfiction. It was in a sense it was easier for me, because fiction I have to really move into the world of the imagination, and I really trust free-flowing stream of consciousness. So I have to trust the unconscious in a whole different way. I know I write dramatic fiction, meaning that I stay with a good character arc. I have a beginning, middle, and end. There is a moral or a theme to the story. There is a, you know, good guy, bad guy, and then there's resolution, and you're not sure what that resolution is going to be. But there is a level of trust, yes, because sometimes I'm not formulaic in that I don't have a set plan. I really trust the flow of the unconscious, and it really takes me by surprise, and sometimes I don't want to write it. But if I don't, then I'm clogged, and I'd have to become very formulaic, and I could pump that out, but it's the words would be left flat and very inert and lifeless. Here I'm trusting it, and there's risk with it. Like just this past week, I had a reviewer write to me and tell me that they will, because you can have pdeblasi@gmail.com is on my website, and people can write to me and let me know how they're doing, or you know, their opinions of the book, and then they post on Amazon or Goodreads. But this person said, you know, I couldn't finish the book. It was too much of a trigger for me. This and they were referring to Goddess of Everything, my latest novel. This is a metaphysical thriller in which the mother becomes a nun, and her husband has died. She's very psychic. She's very mystic. Propensities toward the psychic realm are profound. She's gifted, but she uses them for dark reasons. But she's a wolf in sheep's clothing. So she seems very good, and her son is captivated by her spell, as everyone around her is, because she does such good work. And she's the mother superior of the order, but behind the scenes, she uses dark energy. But on the surface of everyday life, she's accomplishing good with it. But there's more to that story. And the reviewer said, it was just too frightening for me. And the woman was just too evil. Do personalities really become this ill and yet appear so good, you know? And they said, I can't review it. I can't finish reading it. So I got that, you know, and I totally understood that. And then I have other readers who say, I just love the book. But what I had to do is I locked myself in a very small closet. I shut the door when everybody in the house was asleep. I closed the door, and I got my flashlight, and I read from cover to cover. And 3 hours later, I came out, and I peeked out the door. They said, it sounds ridiculous. This was a woman. It sounds ridiculous, but I had to actually make sure it was safe outside.
Yeah.
So there's a definite fright to the books, but it comes because because I do tap into the raw dimension of the unconscious mind, but there's always transformative potential, and the story is not left without hope.
Hmm. Yeah, what you're getting at there is what I've always considered probably the biggest challenge in writing a story, especially for me, because mine are very psychological too. In fact, I have one novel that's extremely psychological. It's all about, you know, breakthroughs and overcoming your sense of self and finding out who you really are, developing a sense of identity, dealing with trauma, all that kind of, you know, usual cliche stuff, except I like to think I did a little more creatively than a lot of them are out there. But to me, the biggest challenge is, in order to tap into that subconscious, the feelings, the reactions, and the reactions that come from the sum of all their properties, you have to give your characters the motivation and the dimensions so that people understand that and it seems real to them. Now, that's basic. That's basic writing. It's like, okay, you've got a character. This character got attacked by dogs, got severely injured when she was a kid, and now as an adult, when she gets close to a dog, she freezes up and she has a psychological reaction. That's easy to understand and easy to explain. But where the trick is it easy to empathize with? Most people in that example, yeah, they can understand that. But when you're trying to create a character whose reactions are coming out of the subconscious and they don't seem to make sense, you're going to have to figure them out and sort them out and figure out what's causing this person to react differently than most readers would have reacted. Now you've got a challenge because you want your readers to empathize with that character and to feel that character's pain. But if they don't understand why the character feels that or understands it, you're going to lose the reader. And to me, that's the number one challenge when I'm writing these things, is to try to put it in a way so that the reader can find something to identify with and feel that feeling. And Paul, what you've just been describing is that process. And I really appreciate you talking about that.
You know, it's so true, Stephen, because it's, I'm a psychologist. I'm a depth psychologist. I work with the unconscious, and we always have to enter into therapy knowing that we're going to be tapping into the past. There are childhood dynamics that don't strictly determine, they do not strictly determine a person's mental health, but they are significant in determining that person's mental health. And then the person has choices. You know, it's like, it depends. You get the hand you're dealt, then what matters is how you play that hand. Then the person has choices, and you can choose to feed the good wolf, or you can feed the bad wolf. And therapy helps to facilitate individuals in understanding that there are destructive and there are life-giving principles. What Freud talked about is thanatos and eros. You know, love and death. There's a love drive and a death drive, and then we choose. Free will is a phenomena. Now we're limited, as each story shows, in our ability to choose good if we haven't worked out the bad already or faced the bad. That's part of what makes the psychopath, even if it's a mother superior in a convent, it's so capable of doing bad in the midst of seeming good. They can be highly manipulative and very hurtful under the name of goodness. You know, it's for your own good, or it's for the good of this or that organization, or it's for the good of one's soul or whatever. But in reality, they're being highly manipulative, cunning, and ultimately destructive. And it's hard to see that. In order to come to terms with that, for instance, with Mother Juana is her name. She's a mother superior. I had to delve into her childhood dynamics briefly. And you do feel for her. You see the reason why she is the way that she is. But you also see that she had a choice. There's a proverbial crossroads. Now, which road are you going to take? Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens in the first novel with the Archbishop, you know, because these are all three of these novels, each of my novels thus far have explored the dark side of religion. And in the first one, The Unholy, it's about a very dynamic, very charismatic, and very wicked Archbishop of Aslan. And he is beloved. and he is feared because of his power, but you see his background, his history, and how his childhood dynamics brought him to where he was, and how he then exploited the dark side of all of that for his own needs, for narcissistic needs, for power and for ego and for control over the masses. And then the protagonist, Claire, I'm not going to tell you a whole lot about her because it's there's a mystery to be discovered in that story with regard to her. And she has to come to terms with that because she has to come up against Archbishop William Anarch. And she's a very young woman, and he's a very seasoned and crafty old archbishop.
Cool.
Okay, we're going to cut out into a commercial here real quick. We are on with Paul DeBossi III, and we're talking some pretty deep stuff here. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Lucifer loses his day job, so he starts his own gig. A little girl's tantrum destroys her toys, but will they lash out in revenge? Can a miserable housewife find a new life for herself in a tear-stained old painting? Eerie charms of the short story, fantasy, mystery, and horror includes a snake deciding the fate of the world, a slot machine choosing life's winners and losers, a malevolent fairy dancing men to their deaths, a couple desperate to escape a train station, the dog show judge facing death, and more great tales. Proudly published by Fresh Ink Group, Eerie Charms is available worldwide in jacketed hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats. Patricia A. Guthrie offers a cauldron of eerie delights that will please, delight, and yet terrify you.
All right. If you like short stories with a little darkness and a little humor intermingled, check that one out. That's a stellar collection of short stories by Patricia A. Guthrie. Paul, now, you had touched on that you have a daughter that lives in Italy now. So tell us a little bit about your family, wife, kids, grandkids.
Sure. We're a family of artists and writers, as we like to say. My wife is my wife of 45 years now, Kate, is an artist and art historian, and we've raised four children together. And our eldest is an artist and designer in New York. He got his MFA in sculpture and three-dimensional design at Hunter College, CUNY, City University of New York, and has been practicing there for 20 years. My second daughter, our second daughter, is a poet. She has an MFA in creative writing and poetry out of University of Maryland, has taught in inner city D.C. and in the Bronx, and came back home and teaches at Native American Charter School and published poet. And my third daughter is a PhD in English literature, and she has two novels out, and she's a professor of gender studies and the occult, and at the University of New Mexico, and also teaches at the local community college. And then our youngest who lives in Italy, is an MFA out of California College of the Arts in sculpture and three-dimensional design, and went to Italy as a Fulbright scholar and decided to stay in Florence. She and her husband, Connor, is a writer. I've known him so long as these years go by. He's a high literary writer, and they did their MS together, and they're involved in the artists and writers scene throughout Europe, actually. But she teaches, she's a professor at the Florence Institute of Art and Design, and Connor is a translator and a tutor and writer. So that's our family. Yeah.
Wow. No wonder you don't want to talk about a bunch of slackers like that, huh?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I love them. I'm sorry. Yeah. I hope I didn't go on too long.
No. That's definitely to be proud. Yeah.
So,
that's pretty cool.
So I'm guessing your children grew up in a nourishing, nurturing kind of a household where if they were into something, you nurtured that along?
Yeah. They, you know, if they wanted to be engineers and accountants or whatever, then that's what we would have talked about and tapped into and gone with. But they all were about the arts, either literary or visual, and excuse me, and that's what we nourished. And their mother was tremendous with the literary arts, with the visual arts, and literary arts too. She's a very fine writer. She has a great blog, and her actual background began in English literature. So we both did our best to nourish the writers and visual artists. I do some visual art as well. I carve stone. So
interesting.
Wow.
Yeah, we've had that pulse and beat in our family. And I think it seemed to have taken.
Well, we need to roll another commercial here. Listeners, we're on with author Paul DeBlasi III, PhD, and we're looking forward to hearing about his practice and his day job and the other things he does after this.
Best-selling author Gwen M. Plano presents The Culmination, A New Beginning, the final book in the Contract thriller series. In the first book, co-penned by best-selling author John W. Howell, the Earth is threatened with a catastrophic event, and Heaven's leadership intervenes with extraordinary measures to ensure the survival of the planet. In Book 2, The Choice, a confidential team uncovers a traitorous conspiracy that has as its goal world domination. The pressing question is, who can be trusted and who cannot? The Culmination, A New Beginning brings the Contract thriller trilogy to a close. After an assassination attempt on an Air Force base in Northern California, tensions mount. Heads of state meet to craft a denuclearization agreement. The meetings between these nuclear powers take a murderous turn. A nefarious conspiracy reemerges and leads the characters into the heart of the Middle East, where they encounter the unexpected and find a reason for hope. Grab your copy now of The Culmination, A New Beginning by Gwen M. Plano. Available worldwide in hardcover, paperback, and all major ebook formats. The Culmination is proudly published by Fresh Ink Group.
Right.
Now, there's a video for that over on YouTube in the Fresh Ink Group channel. Check it out, like it, subscribe, share, put money in an envelope, mail it to us, whatever moves you.
Yeah, there are videos for all of those, for most of these commercials. So get over there, YouTube, Fresh Ink Group. Like, subscribe, do all that good stuff. It helps us out.
So, Paul, you're a busy man. You've got a practice. You're a writer. You interact with fans. You do things through your website. What all are you involved in, and how do you fit this together?
I try and as much as possible Monday through Thursday, and it's I always actually really focus on it and largely successful is focusing strictly on clinical practice by 5 in the morning, and I do a workout, and then have time to catch some breakfast and read the morning news, and then I do some social media PR for my books, and then I'm off with patients all day long, and that's what I focus on. That's part of why I'm really appreciative to the both of you that we were able to pre-record this session, this podcast, because I'm just not able to do it during the week, because all of my energy really needs to be focused on my patients, and that's what I want to do. And then Friday through Sunday, I write, and I focus on my stories. I give myself a little transition time on Friday morning, and then I'm off and at it, and I write through the weekend, and plus we do some hiking. We're only 20 minutes from the beautiful Sandia Mountains. We're a mile high here in Albuquerque, and we can go up to another mile, so 2 miles high in the Sandia Mountains, and love to hike, play tennis, and we watch a lot of film and good series on Netflix and the like, and play the guitar and have fun. Kate and I live a good life. Two of our daughters are here, and one is married with two wonderful grandchildren. So all of that weaves together to make life good and really enjoyable. And as I keep a balance, I think it contributes to good story writing. So for me, you know, as I feel like I'm able to just write as optimally as I have in me. I had a interesting exchange with my daughter a number of years ago, the one in Italy, if I could just pass it on. I'm really careful not to overwrite. And because once I get to that white hot pitch point in writing, it can be difficult to stop. And then I find that I'm just drained, and I don't like to get to that point. And I was talking to my daughter, and she said, you know, Dad, you got to be careful because the muse always wants more. And it's proven true. I like to leave a little bit in the reserve every day. So I could write more, but I don't. I leave a little energy in the reserve. And then usually my dreams pick up on it. And by that night, I've been dreaming about what the next scene is and which way I'm to go. So, yeah, that's my process, and that's my life, and that's the living of it. So.
And you save a little bit of starter yeast from each batch, huh?
Boy, yes, I do my best, and I'm largely successful, I think.
Now, where do your story ideas come from, and how do you cultivate them as they're coming to you?
Yeah, right. Well, I get a lot of ideas, but I wait for something to linger and not go away. And then if that happens, then I begin writing. And it usually starts, once the one lingers, I'll get a title and I'll have an initial image. And it stayed around for, before I begin a story, it stayed around for at least a year. And then I'll write the story. My new novel that I'm writing right now is Seer, the story of the case of the man who lost his soul. And that's lingered with me for a good year and a half before I started it. And it comes out of, these stories come out of personal life experience and clinical experience with patients over 40 years now. And personal life experience always coming in, because I'm 69 years old now, so there's a lot of stuff, you know, that enters in there that I think helps to move the story along, provide some momentum, and yet grounded in realities of everyday life, while also tapping into realities that I know are phenomenologically very real, like the reality of dreams and intuition, synchronous events, and what appear to be magical happenings in life, if we're willing to see them, because we don't catch them unless our eyes are open to see them. And then all of a sudden we start seeing them everywhere. And that's part of what the stories help readers to dip into, that there's magic happening all the time. And so everything comes from my clinical experience. No story is ever written about one patient in particular. It's a combination. It's an amalgam of years and years of experience that boil down to one protagonist and one antagonist, and then supporting characters.
Now, do you ever work with others on your stories, either the writing process or just bouncing ideas off of, like, maybe your wife or
no,
other writers?
No, I don't. It because it's come to me and it lingers, and then I write it out, and I have to really trust that process. And then I have you both are writers, so you know how this goes. It takes my writings, my novels are short, 50 to 60,000 words. And that's about somewhere 2.25 to 250 pages. But that's taken me 2 to 3 years. So I including, and that's not just writing out, that's hundreds of edits and writes and rewrites. Then I hand it over to my team of beta readers, and I have about 3 or 4 beta readers that they don't know me personally, and they're good at beta reading for metaphysical, paranormal, horror, and now Seer is going to have more of an urban fantasy emphasis. And then I hand it over to a professional editor who is Chris Hull of Chris Hull Editing, and I love Chris. She is just she's certified by the I believe it's called the American Copy Editors Association, and she's just superb. She's probably the best editor I've had for 40 years, and I've been with traditional presses and have dealt with a lot of editors, and she is really good. So, and then I get her editorial work, and we go back and forth, and then it's published once we finish it up and take it as far as we can. But I don't go back and forth. I know a lot of people find that helpful, but that's not my process.
Yeah,
you want to spell mm-hmm. Chris for us before you move on? Is it Chris with a K or C-H-R-I-S?
C-H-R-I-S, Chris All, Chris Hull, editor, and it's Editing Hull.
Okay.
And that's the name of her company, EditingHull.com. Mm-hmm.
EditingHull.com. All right. Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, you said something interesting about as you're developing your story that the title comes pretty early. I did a blog article about that, and I talked to some other writers, and it surprised me how many other writers the title comes. My title comes late, probably midway through to late in the story, as I'm writing it. Then I get a feel for what it, you know, what the story's about and what it should be called. But it surprised me when I did this blog article. I heard from so many people that they'll get the title first. And then they'll write from it, or they'll get the title after they've written a paragraph or two. And it's like, wow, okay. I just find that interesting.
Yeah. You know, for all of us, our process is so, so different. So,
mm-hmm.
so different. Maria, the English literature professor, her process is a fascinating one to me. Very similar to mine, but very, very different. She's been living out her story for years in various nuances of her life, and then it comes together. She came out about a year ago with Weep Woman Weep, which has been, she's gotten great reviews on it, but that title came to her very early. And the character was front and center, and then she wrote from that position. So she saw the character very clearly at the beginning, and then the title as well. Whereas for me, it's the title and the sort of experience of it, and then the protagonist comes out, and then the antagonist begins to emerge.
Okay.
So we all have different processes.
Yeah. And that's creativity. I mean, what works for one person may not work for the other, and what may not work for that person works for the other.
Right,
cool.
Right.
So, Beam, let's roll another commercial, and then we'll ask Paul about how he actually publishes.
All right.
What drives a man to spend 26 years performing night after night? To persevere through a stifling tour bus, bad food, strange women, flared tempers, a plane nearly blown from the sky. Just how did that troubled military brat with a dream claw his way from dirt floor dive bar shows to the world's biggest stages? Aviator, author, and Country Music Hall of Fame drummer Mark Herndon lived that dream playing with Alabama, one of the most popular and celebrated bands of all time. He learned some hard lessons about people and life, the music industry, the accolades and awards, how easy it is to lose it all, and how hard it is to survive, to embrace sobriety, to live even one more day. Herndon's poignant memoir offers a tale at once cautionary and inspirational, delightful and heartbreaking, funny yet deeply personal. From innocence to rebellion to acceptance, can a man still flourish when the spotlight dims? Are true forgiveness, redemption, and serenity even possible when the powerful say everything you achieved somehow doesn't even count? That you're not who you and everyone who matters thought you were? Find all this and more in Mark's remarkable memoir, The High Road, Memories from a Long Trip. Proudly published by Fresh Ink Group in paperback and ebooks, and now in the keepsake dust-jacketed hardcover edition demanded by true fans. Mark Herndon refuses to slow down, so look back, look ahead, and join him on the trip. He's taking the high road.
Boy, talk about timing. While we were listening to that commercial, I got a text from Leah Seawright, Mark Herndon's wife. She's also a country music singer and star and working on her new album right now. We're trying to put together a fish fry so we can all get together, and she's going back and forth with me now. So, yeah. Now, once Chris Hall tells you that this thing's ready to go, Paul, Hallowed Realms Press, is that you?
Hallowed Realms Press is my imprint. I was initially with Sunstone Press in Santa Fe, a traditional publishing house, and they're fantastic people there. But that was back in 2013 when I first began publishing fiction. And the whole indie world hadn't quite caught momentum yet, and I wasn't as aware of it. Then once I did become aware of it, I wanted to really experiment with moving indie and having my own imprint. And I had already retained my rights, and Sunstone Press was marvelous, and they were fully supportive of me. And so I decided to move into indie, and I formed Hallowed Realms Press and have published now three novels, The Unholy, Goddess of the Wild Thing, and Goddess of Everything under Hallowed Realms Press, and really do love the indie world. The creativity and marketing, and I can bring it to press a lot less expensively than a traditional publisher, and then have versatility with regard to PR that is quite a bit more limited for me as compared to a traditional publisher. So yeah, I love it. Yeah.
Now, right. You did. You told us about The Unholy already, and you've mentioned Goddess of the Wild Thing. That was your second book?
Goddess of the Wild Thing was my second book. It's about it's about love, and is bad love better than no love at all? And it's a woman's struggle her struggle with love, and she's a middle-aged professor. She's professor of esoterica at the University of Aslan, and she has a group of friends, and it takes place in downtown Aslan, and it's really set in Albuquerque, literally, but it's Aslan del Sur, which is southern, and Aslan del Norte, which is northern, is Santa Fe and Española, where the other two novels take place. But Goddess of the Wild Thing is also a metaphysical thriller, and it's set in a very urban noir setting, and it's very frightening, and I'll go ahead and say a very redemptive book. So, it's about a struggle with love. And
does she travel to this place, or is this all internal, or what?
Aslan is the name of the city in the book. and Aslan del Sur, and New Mexico itself, this is a very the culture here is it's loaded with mysticism, and so what I do is I dramatize that mysticism in the midst of everyday life, and she's a professor of esoterica, so you start seeing the workings of the unconscious mind played out in everyday life regarding what is love, and how do we get to love, and how do we find true love, and are we willing to settle for something rather than having nothing at all? And it's her struggles played out in a metaphysical dimension, in a metaphysical way. So all of my novels are happen in everyday life with real people, but they're experiencing a metaphysical reality, what William James, the father of American psychology, called the great unseen. So it's the unseen world that lies behind the workings of everyday life and influences everything. So we see this played out dramatically regarding love, and what is good love, what is bad love, and is it worth it to settle for something less than good love?
Can you give us some examples of like some of the metaphysical happenings or unexpected turns of fate or things that are happening to her? I mean, what's it like when this happens?
What's it like when this happens? Well, she falls in love. And okay. And what she's fallen in love with Aslan's most notorious criminal lawyer, Sam Scheer, and she is Professor Eve Sanchez, and she's fallen in love with this notorious lawyer, and she's fallen in love with him, and on she goes home to her small adobe near the campus. And she finds scrawled on her the lintel of her home to the door to the portico an evil message, a threatening evil message in blood, and she sees the head of birds the body of birds and snapped off at the head. And their blood, their bodies used to inscribe this message, and her dreams then tap in to the evil taking place behind the scenes, and she calls her an old friend who runs the metaphysical bookstore, and she agrees to meet with her late in the day, and as she goes to the metaphysical bookstore, she enters with another friend of hers who's a physician, and it's eerie, and they walk in, and the minute that they walk in, all of the crystals and all of the they have these small bells that hang start to move, there's ringing, and there's an odd sense in the room, and there's a sulfuric smell, and she goes back, they find their way, and it's very creepy, the whole scenario, and they find her friend in a state, I'm going to say, I won't go into what that is, but the back window has been shattered, and there is what seems to be something that could happen, okay, but in reality, we also understand that it's too creepy to just happen. I'm not going to tell you the exact happening that occurred, but it affected her friend in a very shocking manner. And it's what we would call synchronicity, where the inner world and outer world come together in ways that can be quite edifying or quite frightening. And it takes place in that moment in time with a friend, an older friend who was willing to extend herself and help her, but this evil in the background intervened so as to prohibit that. And,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, you're the kind of author that I really like because you write depth. There's nothing shallow here. And it's, you know, there's some good stories that are, you know, more shallow and all that. But you're writing with depth. Now, your current work, that's Goddess of Everything?
No, Goddess of Everything is out. That's the evil mother. That's the mother who was the head of the mother, the convent and the orphanage. And my current work is Seer, the case of the man who lost his soul. This is actually, just briefly, very akin to a favorite writer of mine, Algernon Blackwood, and his John Silence mysteries, and Dr. John Silence, who's a psychic detective. He's an MD who uses his skills for psychic purposes.
Okay.
And he goes by case by case by case, and this is the first case for Seer, and that may well turn out to be a series. This is the case of the man who lost his soul.
Now, Seer, that's the one you're working on right now?
That's the one I'm working on right now.
Do you have any idea on a release date?
No. It's taking a bit of time because I had to do a professional article first and get that published for Routledge. And then this is going to take me about another year to finish.
And then
we'll go through the editing.
Yeah, now, Paul, you have some great-looking covers. How do you get your covers done?
And, yeah, my covers are these covers have changed through the years, and I've learned that it's good to keep things fresh and keep things moving, you know. And sometimes a cover change is good. And so Chris Hall helped me with that, and she was able to guide me, and she uses different folks. And in this case, I was able to tap in and really like the works of the book Khaleesi. And that's the title of the cover designer is the book Khaleesi. That's the name of the business.
Have you had some interaction with fans directly, or you got some reviewers that you're particularly fond of, what they say about your books, or anything like that? Any feedback out there that you like to talk about?
Oh yeah, we've had a really nice influx of of reviews on Goddess of Everything lately, and this is the latest book, and I just tapped into a really good writer pal, and I really love his works of paranormal thrillers, Eric Wilder out of Louisiana, and I saw that he had picked up Goddess of Everything, and I just pulled it up as you asked, and and this is a seasoned indie writer who writes very good paranormal thrillers and set in Louisiana and all of the voodoo magic there. And Eric wrote Goddess of Everything, complex tale of reality, religion, and horror. And he said it reminds him of Martin Cruz Smith's Nightwing and The Exorcist. So he said, if you like beautifully written psychological horror, grab this book. And that's a wonderful review. And I have it looks like, let me peek here. There's about what do I have?
I have about like one I would frame and hang.
Yeah. I have about 68 reviews, and it's 4.5 stars in total compiled on Amazon. So, I'm very appreciative for those reviews. I did for The Unholy. I got one star review, I believe, for The Unholy, and that's had a lot of reviews. I think I'm over 100 now. like 114 reviews or something like that. And I believe one-star reviewer thought I was just anti-religion, and it was terrible that I would say this stuff about religion. And what was missed in that, unfortunately, I think I touched a religious complex for this fellow, because in reality, it's not an anti-religion book, but it looks critically at the dark side of religion. And that's to be emphasized, that people need to make up their own minds about religion, whether they find any religion, whether they find it meaningful or not. A lot of people find the development of a more personal spirituality more to their liking than a organized religion. But this one person just said they couldn't take it. They had a very strong emotional reaction, so it wasn't. they were really, you know, buttons were pushed, and they gave it one star because they thought it's against religion.
I mean, you know, there's people that have had bad experiences with organized religion. I mean, that's to be expected, and you know, and then there's the defensive ones. And now, in our listening audience, we have a lot of aspiring authors and some authors that are just getting ready to publish for the first time and whatnot. What advice would you have for some of these up and coming authors?
Boy, I tell you, for these up and coming authors, if you feel the urge to write, do it, and don't stop. Because I just had one of my pals, he's 87 years old. He's a world-renowned psychoanalyst. We all joke with him. Michael Eigen, he wrote a fantastic book, The Psychoanalytic Mystic. And I'm in a weekly study group with Mike. He's a professor at NYU. And he's continuing to see patients and write and publish. And he says, you know what, guys, this writing gig, he says, just keep doing it. He said, and the more you do it, the better you get at it, and you learn as you go, and pretty soon you have book after book after book, and he's published more than Freud. We joke with him, and it's true. He's published at this point more books than Freud. He has 33 books out, and he's Michael Eigen, The Psychoanalytic Mystic. His books are fantastic, and I stick with what Mike says. You just keep doing it, Pinon, you'll get there.
All right. Well, our guest this week has been Paul DeBlasi III, author, depth psychologist, and all-around philosopher, from what I'm gathering here, out of New Mexico. Paul, how do people find you out there if they want to contact you or follow you on social media? You know, you got a website, blog, social media mm-hmm. handles.
Right. And my website is PaulDeBlasi3rd.com. Okay. And
now, excuse me, Paul. No, you said Paul DeBlasi mm-hmm. III. Is that Paul DeBlasi III?
Yeah, Paul DeBlasi III. Yeah, Paul DeBlasi.
Because if they type in the, they're not going to get it.
No. Paul DeBlasi III. And Twitter is P DeBlasi. III, P. DeBlasi III, you know, P. DeBlasi mm-hmm. III.
Yeah.
And then P. DeBlasi @gmail.com.
Cool.
I also have, let me see if I can, I'm getting used to my, let's see if I can tap into this now. And, If you wouldn't mind, I'm going to give you the TikTok too,
okay.
If I can get it here.
For the kids now.
It's a great thing, but I think it's Henry Roy is helping me with that, and he just sent me the link. And anyway, if you'll check on, I'm still getting used to it, but I've gotten about. We've gotten about 1,000 followers there, and we're growing. It would take me a minute to tap back into that. So, but anyway,
well,
check
pass it on to us, so we can put it in the newsletter coming up too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Paul,
all right.
It's a pleasure having you on. We've been kind of following you for a lot of years here and looking forward to actually spending some time with you, and we're thrilled to have had that chance.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, I appreciate your reaching out, and it was really great to do this. I'm glad we could pre-record it, and you do some fantastic work there at Fresh Ink, and let's stay in touch.
Yeah, definitely. We appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this with us.
Okay, listeners, we'll be live again next week. We do have more guests coming booked in the weeks to come. What else we got happening, Beam?
Well, like you said, we got more guests to come. And hopefully by the time you're hearing this, I will be finished with at least one of the audiobooks, either Jenny Wong's Girl Wears Those Shoes or Ellie Collins' Mad Max and Sweet Sarah. Both of those are coming along, and you know, hopefully by the time this airs, one of those will be in the final post-production, and keep an eye on the newsletter for that. And remember, get over to freshinkgroup.com, hit that newsletter subscription page, and subscribe.
Now, besides having more guests, we're also going to be doing some how-to stuff and some how things are getting done kind of stuff as well. Plus, we're noodling some cool ideas for some special shows as well. But listen, people, help us get those subscribers over on YouTube, Fresh Ink Group channel. Get over there, subscribe, help us spread the word. Go to freshinkgroup.com, subscribe to that newsletter. And as always, when you see an indie author book that you like, get out there and post a review.
Yeah. And help spread the word for our authors. When we've got these new books coming out and you see it posted on social media, share it and help the rest of these authors get their names out there. And we will see you again next week, everybody.
Thanks again, Paul DeBlasi III.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a wonderful time.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
You've been a part of Voice of Indie, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.